flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring, backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales. Visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Good morning. It is 9:04 Wednesday, September 29th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And as loath as I am to talk about the Red Sox, I got Phil's pulse check after losing four in a row.
Joe, I got to admit it. It's not looking good, but we still have games against the Orioles and Nationals. They're going to make the postseason, and then only to crush me even further in the wild card game, they're going to lose 14-1 to the Yankees.
Hey, I'm Kelsey Riley, international editor of the TDN. I'm not going to get into that banter, but I'm just excited to be back with you guys on Christmas week, a.k.a. ARC week.
Yeah, that's right. We're glad to have Kelsey here. And honestly, the less Red Sox talk, the better. But I had to needle Bill with that just for now.
Yeah.
The TDN Writers Room is presented by Keeneland. We're just 9 days away from the start of the Keeneland Fall Meet. Opening weekend marks the track's 85th anniversary with lots of exciting runners nominated for Fall Stars Weekend and opening weekend. Lots of Breeders' Cup Challenge races. Latruska will hope to get her fifth consecutive graded stakes win in the Judmont Spencer Stakes, trying to lock up that Horse of the Year title. Plus, several high-profile horses are looking to defend their titles from last year with Ivar in the Keeneland's and Keeneland's Shadwell Turf Mile, which I liked him last year. Hopefully he can repeat. Diamond Oops in the Grade 2 Stole Keenan Ogden Phoenix Stakes. And in the midst of Biz, who pulled off a big upset in the Grade 2 Thoroughbred Cup of America Stakes. So definitely very important for them to defend their titles going into the Breeders' Cup. And we're looking forward to that Keeneland Fall Meet big time. All right, so the big action over the weekend was at Parks. It was a great card, lots of great stakes, but obviously the headliner and the headline race was going to be Hot Rod Charlie in the Pennsylvania Derby. He was very impressive. There was a little bit of controversy with him drifting out at the top of the stretch, carrying Midnight Bourbon wide. I thought it was the right call to leave him up. I generally do not like that kind of hurting and drifting, and I think it should be discouraged. But, you know, with the way he won, with the way he finished up, I don't think you can say that it cost Midnight Bourbon the win in that race. So I think that was the right call. And the main thing I really thought about that race was Hot Rod Charlie, to me, is probably going to be one of the unluckiest non-champion three-year-olds in history. You know, with the year that he's had, he ran that monster race in the Belmont where he was setting this blazing pace, just got run down late by Essential Quality. Then obviously the race in the Haskell where he was, I think, much the best. He was wide on both turns and then got DQ'd, obviously, because of the incident in mid-stretch, which, I don't know, to this day, I still think you could say was not entirely his fault. I thought that there was some mutual bumping there with Mandaloon as well. And then, you know, in this race, this is the kind of performance that I think might vault him to the top of the three-year-old division in any other year. But because Essential Quality has had such a great year, he won the Travers, he won the Belmont, I think it's not going to be enough. Unless maybe he wins the Breeders' Cup Classic in really impressive fashion, maybe he can change some voters' minds. But that was my main takeaway, was that in any other year, I feel like Hot Rod Charlie would be a lock for three-year-old champion, but it just has been such a star-crossed year for him in terms of getting what he deserved in these big races. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I agree with every single point you made. And, you know, he looks like he's got a chance in the Breeders' Cup Classic. I mean, why not? You could argue that he's as good as Essential Quality. I don't think you would say that he's better because Essential Quality has had such a good year. But, you know, based on the performances, based on his race in the Belmont, where even though he was second, he was likely the better horse of the two, you could make an argument that he might just be the best three-year-old out there. And that was the other thing, too. I mean, you don't really feel sorry for a horse because they don't know, of course, what's going on. But, man, is he unlucky with what he's done this year and all the things that you just said. If ever a horse deserved a big win like this, this was a case, and now he goes forward into the Breeders' Cup. I also agree with you 100%. That would have been a terrible DQ to take it down there. Wouldn't that have been, you know, just one more? Just, you know, oh my goodness, you know, can't this poor horse get a break? But, you know, I guess Flavien Prat was just race riding, and you know, whether it's something that should be encouraged or discouraged or not, I mean, that's a subject for another day. But it definitely wasn't anything that he warranted a disqualification. So the race became easier, obviously, when Medina Spirit, through those sort of mysterious circumstances, was in and then out. And now he's going to run in California this weekend. So, you know, he beat a very good field, a field that would have been better with Medina Spirit in there. But he had two thumbs up for a good performance from tonight, Charlie. Excuse me, how about Charlie?
Yeah, I agree. It was great to see Hot Rod Charlie get that much deserved grade one. I agree that it was the right call. It was unfortunate to see, you know, that hurting out at the top of the stretch, but I think he was the best horse. He was going to win. And I also agree that, you know, what happened in the Haskell, while he deserves to come down after the incident happened, I don't know that it was entirely his fault. So it was really good to see him finally put it all together and get that deserved grade one. And, you know, I don't think that the three-year-old championship is necessarily tied up. I think we really do have to see what happens in the Breeders' Cup. It looks, you know, very tight at the moment between him and Essential Quality. And of course, you're going to have, you know, many other top horses in there like Nick's Go. So, I mean, it might be a lot to ask at this stage, but my wish would just be to see a cleanly run race where we can see every horse put in their best effort and I guess really see who the best three-year-old is.
Yeah, no controversy, no drug DQs, no DQs of any kind. Definitely would like to see that, you know, the horses just settle it on the racetrack for once in this crazy year that we've had. I just wanted to mention a couple other performances from the weekend. Jackie's Warrior obviously was devastating and incredible. And I want to talk about Life is Good too in the Kelso. Now that race was basically a walkover for him. There was really nobody in that race that could mess with him on paper. And it played out that way on the track, especially in that he got an easy lead. He was able to dictate pretty soft fractions, especially for him. But just in general, I tweeted this after the race. It was good to see both of them, you know, come right back off of that big duel in the Allen Jerkins and run their races, because, you know, the races like that can take a lot out of a horse, especially for Life is Good, because he was coming off of that long layoff and the injuries. For him to come back, run that huge race in Saratoga, and then be able to come back and run so well in the Kelso. He only got a 99 buyer, but I thought he finished up great. You know, 134 and change is really moving for a mile, especially if you go in 110 for three quarters. So he definitely finished up really strong. And I think the two of them are going to be very tough to beat in their respective Breeders' Cup races. Now, they're probably not going to meet in the Breeders' Cup. It looks like Jackie's Warrior is going to go to the sprint, while Life is Good is going to go to the dirt mile. But, you know, I just, now that the three-year-old male conversation is basically down to Essential Quality and Hot Rod Charlie, I think we also have to appreciate the three-year-old male sprinters and milers. And it's just what a deep class of three-year-olds we've had this year. And it's nice to be able to see them all strut their stuff on a day like Saturday. And it really sets up for a really intriguing Breeders' Cup, where I think, you know, in a lot of races, the three-year-olds really have a great shot against the elder horses. And I don't think that's always the case. So I think we've been blessed to see a lot of great three-year-olds this year. And we talked about it last week, all the really good two-year-old performances we've had so far this year. Might have even more next year, even more to talk about with these top class three-year-olds. I wonder if you guys had any thoughts about the rest of the races on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, sticking with the three-year-old sprinters, Joe, I mean, I don't want to take anything away from them, particularly Life is Good, but I mean, to me, what did that race, I mean, to prove that he's fine, that he's still a good horse, et cetera. But, you know, consider, I mean, when's the last time you saw a horse pay 210 to win? We're not talking about bridge jumpers to show. And when Chance It was pulled up, it became a three-horse race. The horse that finished second was a $50,000 claimer. I mean, he did what he had to do. I mean, you know, he went out and won easily. But, you know, that race didn't really prove anything to me. But at the same time, I mean, you know, if his year kind of worked out differently and he was more lucky earlier in the year and didn't get hurt, we might be talking about him as the favorite for the Breeders' Cup Classic, because, you know, let's go back to back in March and everything about how good he looked and how everybody just thought this was, you know, going to be a sensational horse. And Jackie's Warrior down at Parks and Gallon, Bob, pretty much more the same. I mean, in an easy spot where he really would have had to do something wrong to lose, he got the job done. But I do agree. I mean, you know, if you add them to the mix, you know, they're not contenders for the three-year-old championship because of the strength of Hot Rod Charlie and the sense of quality. I think Jackie's Warrior very easily could be sprint champion. In fact, if he went to Breeders' Cup, sure he will be. But yeah, add them to the division. I mean, we've had absolutely a lot of quality this year.
Yeah, and I'm glad we don't have John here just for so he doesn't make the case for Gamine to be champion male sprinter yet. But sorry, Kelsey, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. I think you guys covered the weekend action pretty well. The only thing I would just echo what you said, Joe, about how it's nice to see the top 2-year-olds from last year coming and really, really still being competitive this year, like Essential Quality and Hot Rod Charlie 1-2 in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, and they're still, fighting out the division. And then of course Jackie's Warrior, didn't quite hit the heights in that Breeders' Cup last year, but he's, gone into a different division, and he's just like an absolute pleasure to watch. He's what an incredible horse.
Yeah. And, like we said in the past, it was good of his connections to back off right after the Southwest and not try to press forward on the Derby trail. Cause they knew right away off of that race that they were better off with a sprinter miler type. It's definitely worked out for them, but it's a good point by Kelsey that Breeders' Cup Juvenile has turned out to be an extremely live race with what these horses have gone on to do this year. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
Take part in the Keeneland November experience this fall. Entry deadline for the Keeneland November sale is Monday, August 2nd. Learn more at november.keeneland.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are beyond thrilled this week. This guy is a very big get for our show. We appreciate him making time. The hottest trainer in the world, I would say, right now, Charlie Appleby. Thanks so much for coming on.
I'm pleased to meet you, and thank you very much for asking me to come on.
Of course. Yeah, no, well, we had an entire segment last week about you and the year you've had, and kind of, in the past 5 years, you really have exploded onto the scene and seem to be winning basically every big race. I know you're a humble guy. You like to live in the moment and you like to stay positive. Just give me a sense of how these past couple of years have been for you and how you've just ticked off these accomplishments one after another. How has it been?
Obviously, that's been fantastic for myself, more importantly for the team and Godolphin. I've been in Godolphin for just going on 20, 22, 23 years now. So on the global scene, I've been around for a long time, and that's where I've felt that's helped me achieve what we've done over the last 2 years in knowing what the race pattern is like and what sort of horse you need to get there. And at the end of the day, without the horses, none of it will be achievable. Thankfully, we've had the horses over the last 2 years, but I've always felt that we had a little bit of a handle on what we needed to run internationally, and thankfully, we chose the right horse and got the right results.
And Charlie, thanks so much for joining us. And we're focusing obviously in on what you've done this year in North America, which has been absolutely phenomenal. You've entered in 10 races. You've won 6 of them. The Jockey Club Derby is not yet a grade one. It will be next year when it's run for its third year. So for all practical purposes, you've won 6 grade one races in the States this year and in Canada as well. We've seen you come over to North America before, but never anything quite like this, both in the amount of races you've run in and the kind of success you had. What happened this year with Godolphin and your operation that you became so active in North American racing?
I think it's the type of horse that we had. Firstly, the fillies in the spring there, in our spring, should we call it, with Althika and Summer Romance, coming over to the States early. Obviously, they campaigned in Dubai, and I felt that their form had risen again in Dubai, not because of the, some people will say, potentially the caliber of horse you're running against wasn't the best, or what you would take on in America, for sure. But what we learned about the fillies was their style of racing and the slick track suited them. For them, with their their profile, that there was never a profile for them to come to Europe the first half of the season anyway. So we consciously made a decision early that they would ship from Dubai straight to the States. And as we saw, they thrived out there, the two fillies, hand on heart. I thought Summer Romance would reverse the placings with Althika there on her second start there in the Diana. Because of what we saw in Dubai, the switch in distance helped Summer Romance. But look, Althika, she's as tough as teak, as they say. And you know, what she achieved out there was great. And looking forward to what she's on the plane again tomorrow afternoon and tomorrow evening back out to Keeneland for the First Lady. So she's, you know, she was obviously the get-go to it. And then we had Rebels Romance, who unfortunately didn't, we didn't get to see him over there, but I was excited about sending him over there on his profile again of what he achieved in Dubai and the race he ran in Saudi. So look, he's a gelded son of Dubai, so hopefully he's been around for a few years yet. So a bit of luck, I can get him out next year and start to get back onto get back to where I was hoping he could reach to the limits.
And Charlie, you talked there about the strategy with some of those older horses that you've brought across. And of course, you won two grade ones with Albar and Wild Beauty. And then you also have, of course, a fantastic stable of two-year-olds over there in Native Trail, Caribus, Noble Truth. I was just curious, you know, in the winter, spring, when you start getting all of these two-year-olds into your yard, at what stage are you able to sort of sort them out, know what order they fit in, like within your group?
I think we've been very lucky, you know, year on year, you know, I would like to say over the last sort of 4 years, the system we've put in place here, every two-year-old will go through the same system in the spring. You know, they all get broken in pretty much at the same time, obviously during a period of about 6 to 8 weeks. We hope that most of those are broken in. But by the very backward-looking two-year-olds, which you know, it's not much point in trying to ask them any more than what they're potentially doing in the spring. We leave them. So there's 25-30% of the string will be, or the two-year-olds will be just left alone. The other, you know, 70% there, we'll all go through exactly the same program day in, day out. And it's like, well, I like to look at it as a kids in a playground. You know, you see them all running around at the same age, and then you see ones that are doing exactly the same exercise as, you know, his friend next door, but he's strengthening and finding life a lot easier. So therefore, you know, as the weeks go on, you start to put them in their pecking order of, you know, right, he's ready to push a bit more, and he sits where he is, and the other one you drop out and just say, well, he needs more time. So they all start the same, they all go through a program, but I feel that the program we have in place now sort of sorts them out and puts them in their pecking order, you know, early in the spring.
I wonder about your background a little bit and your influences, because you're a relatively young guy. You were in the Godolphin program for a while. You were assistant to Saeed Bin Sarur. But I wonder about your kind of your influences within Godolphin or without or outside of Godolphin. Who were some of the people that maybe took you under their wing early on and taught you things that have allowed you to have this kind of success relatively early in your, you know, individual training career?
I've been very lucky. I've been brought up in the West Country of England there, where life is relaxed, and you become more hands-on down there in dealing with the horses. And so therefore, I started my childhood off there. I moved up the country and went to my first sort of stable in Newmarket was with Susan and Lester Piggott. So, you know, with respects to, you know, racing knowledge, I don't think I could have been... in better hands. I spend a lot of time with Lester watching racing and the great Barney Curley. So I learned how to read a race, I felt there, and understand, you know, the style of racing and pace of race. From there on, I went to David Loders, where again, as I'm sure a lot of you know, his two-year-old academy was, back in the sort of early, late 90s, 2000s, a force to be... to be reckoned with. So I learned a lot about two-year-olds and, you know, how far to push them and what they needed to achieve or what we needed to achieve to get them to group one status. And then obviously on to then from David's, I would join Godolphin. I was joined Godolphin at the age of, I was 19 or 20. So from there on, it was just, you know, very lucky. I had a management position throughout my whole career in Godolphin, just, you know, as I say, started off the traveling. So that allowed me to travel worldwide and go overseas. I spent a lot of time in Arlington and went to Belmont. You know, so again, being in those circles in the Godolphin operation allows you to meet, you know, people out there who are, I would never normally have met in a racing world. You know, but because, you know, Godolphin, we're very lucky. We get moved around the world and, you know, get to meet some great people. They sort of influence you in you know, you see these entrepreneurs and once you've been around those sort of people, you get a buzz off them and you want to, you know, you learn to, you know, that how they strive for success. And I think it sort of gets sort of instilled into you in a way. And obviously who I work for now in Godolphin and His Highness, you know, what we've seen with, you know, Dubai being built and being, you know, nothing's, we never use can't in our vocabulary, should we say. We strive to achieve and if it doesn't happen, well, we take the positives out of it, move on, and negatives we're brushed aside.
Charlie, I understand it's a little bit early and things are fluid and could change, but could you simply run down who you have for the Breeders' Cup, which horses, which races that you're pointing for at this point?
Obviously, we have the four horses who sort of got their sort of win and their in tickets, the 2-year-olds there in Canada, in Albar and Wild Beauty. Albar, he's a gelded son of Dubarby, but he reminds me very similar of Line of Duty. He's a character, but he's one of those little horses there. You put him in a little bit of a dogfight and he enjoys that. And so, you know, Del Mar would suit him there, tight turns there, and probably not being in a visually watching it, you'll never be comfortable watching him, but he'll love it in amongst them all and getting knocked about because he'll put his head down and he'll keep battling. So, you know, he's a player. I'm sure there'll be some classier colts turn up on the day, but one thing he's got is he's got a bit of street cred about him now. So, here you go there. The Philly Wild Beauty, you know, the extent, well, we're always confident stepping up to the mile there in the Nathlama would always suit her. It was a very good, I think she got a very good, rating from over there. So therefore, you know, she appreciated the step up in trip and she learned plenty as well. So she'll head for the Philly race. There was another colt, Dubarby colt, that won the Tattersalls at Newmarket here just recently. Very similar in stature, in a fashion, probably a slightly stronger individual to Albar. Quick ground, travels very well. I feel that he could just be joining Albar in the colts, geldings, in the juvenile mile. Yibir, who we saw at Belmont there, look, he's come back. He's just one of those horses. He's got the constitution of a rhinoceros. I mean, he's danced every dance in England at a good level. And doesn't matter how much you serve it up to him, he just comes back wanting more. And the other horse playing, you know, they've done the race a bit of, and he's come off looking like he was going back over there to have another run. He's in great order. We'll keep an eye on the turf there, a mile and a half there for him. He obviously got his invitation, so we'll keep a good look on that for him. Just see what older horses are there. He's a horse that I hope will be around for a few years yet. So I won't serve it to him too much this year. But if the conditions are right and we feel he could run a big race, he'd be there. And then we'd have hopefully Marsh of the Seas there, who we saw just touched off in the English Guineas, met with a setback after and had the whole summer off, but done well. Very pleased with his reappearance run in the Joel Stakes. If the ground is sensible, we'll go to the QE2 there on Champions Day here, if it's decent ground, and then hopefully that will springboard us on to the Breeders' Cup Mile. But the Breeders' Cup Mile is his ultimate goal. So if I end up having to miss Ascot for that, if the ground is too testing, then I'll do that and we'll head straight to the Breeders' Cup Mile, which I think is tailor-made for him.
Charlie, we're looking forward to the Breeders' Cup for sure, but we're also really looking forward to a certain big race in France this weekend. And you have two wonderful Franco colts in Adair and Hurricane Lane. Just tell us about their well-being since their last races. We know William Buick picked Adair, but where do they rate, in your opinion?
As I say, two great Franco colts with great profiles going into a race. Adair, as we know, he's won the Derby, went on to win the King George, the first horse since Galileo to do so. I'm sure you're all aware of the setback. We met with a minor setback there in his preparation to a trial into an arc, which, yes, it was always annoying. You never want to have a setback at any stage of your career. But anyway, we had that setback there. He missed two gallops within that 10-day period. But the thing is, I've told myself during that point that no horse has ever actually, European or English horse, have won the I won an ARC trial and then gone on to win an ARC. So I took that as a positive that, you know, someone was telling me not to go there. Subsequently, since then, he's not missed a beat, and he couldn't afford to miss a beat either, you know, it's because we were working back from that ARC trial and then going on to an ARC. So he looks great. Williams chose him because, like I say, he's in great order. He is the Derby winner, and the only time Hurricane Lane has ever been beaten was by Adyar. He's the class horse in the race. Hurricane Lane, on the other hand, you know, he's a rock solid horse that's gone on, you know, done what he's done. He's won an Irish Derby, won a Grand Prix de Paris, and won a St. Ledger. But as we all know, no horse has gone and won a St. Ledger and gone on to win an ARC. So I think that was the excitement of running in the 100th running of the ARC, but also potentially able to create history with Hurricane Lane there. Sorry. Is something that again we look for. We don't look back on history. We try and make history, as they say. So we'll have a crack at it. And the rain obviously is forecast in France, as we always know. It potentially does over that weekend. And you know, both colts will handle the softer conditions. But you have to say Hurricane Lane there, it's going to enhance his chances, because it, you know, stamina is going to come into play if that forecast is right, and we know he handles soft ground.
You talked about not looking back on history, trying to make history. That's a good segue to my last question, which is Godolphin's been trying to win the Kentucky Derby for a long time. Looks like they had a great chance this year with Essential Quality. Didn't quite work out with the trip. That, to me, is maybe one of the few mountains left to climb for you as well. You've won so many big races in such a short amount of time. Would you ever think about potentially trying to win the Derby or trying to win big dirt races in America, or are you good on the turf side for now?
I'm still learning about the, trying to get the right horse for the dirt. But no, all joking apart, that, you know, we take our team over to Dubai, and some of those horses have switched to the dirt and been getting on quite well. Obviously Rebel's Romance last year, you know, winning the UAE Derby. You know, he was a horse that obviously coming into this year, you know, with Essential Quality there, we didn't want to heads. We couldn't see ourselves beating a horse like that anyway. He's a fantastic 3-year-old. Staying was going to be more our forte with that horse, the mile and a half plus races. But no, there's no doubt about it. It's there to be won, and we're always looking to try and find that Derby winner, Kentucky Derby winner, more importantly. So it's definitely on the bucket list, and if the right horse comes along, as I've always said, you know, I don't want to turn up, come over just to have a bit of a mini holiday. We want to come over and be competitive. So when the right horse hopefully crosses our path, we'll be there.
Hey, Charlie, thank you so much for making the time. We know it's a really busy week for you. Congratulations on all the success, and best of luck the rest of the year. We'll see you at the Breeders' Cup.
Joe, guys, thanks so much, and I hope to see you at Delmar. Take care,
guys. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. This week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Charlie Appleby, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Spendthrift Farms. Spendthrift had an exciting start to the week on Monday when Mono White Girl, who retired officially last week due to an injury occurred during training, arrived at the farm. Our own Katie Petruniak was there to see her and film her showing up at Spendthrift. And Ned Toffee announced that she's going to be bred to Into Mischief in 2022, which makes sense. And also, yesterday, Spendthrift released their stud fees for 2022, and Into Mischief is going to be $250,000 stud fee, which I think all things considered is pretty reasonable considering what a superstar he is. And I think, you know, most of the fees were pretty reasonable as well. So I saw Bolt Toro was only 20,000, and that's pretty good considering the pop and the buzz that his yearlings have had so far this year. We also talked about Jackie's Warrior earlier. It was super, super impressive in the grade two gallant Bob. He was almost seven lengths in front at the wire in 108.64. You don't see horses run 108 and change too often at Parks. And he's pretty much one of the most exciting stallion prospects in the country right now with what he's done. And also this past weekend, Into Mischief had his 27th Rising Star, which is a huge, huge number with Overstep, who won impressively on debut for Todd Pletcher and Rapoli Stable at Belmont. Also, Yapan, who was retired, son of Uncle Mo. He's going to stand at Spendthrift in 2022 as well. This news broke late last night, and it was confirmed this morning. The Chicago Bears are buying Arlington Park and the Arlington Park land to move, theoretically, the team from Soldier Field, which is in downtown Chicago, to Arlington Heights. They want this huge new sports complex, as every other team wants these days, and they want the taxpayers to pay for it. Don't forget about that. Bill had a great piece on last Saturday in the TDN about the end being here for Arlington. And he talked to a bunch of trainers and just what they're going to do and how they're going to adjust and how much they're going to miss Arlington. And we've talked about this a lot on the show. You know, we've lamented the closing of Arlington Park. We're far from the only ones doing that. You know, in general, I think more racetracks over time need to close, but this was not one of them. This was a place that still got a lot of people to show up at the track and still had its own culture and its own place in Chicago and the activities and everything around Chicago. I think it was still an integral part of the community. Nevertheless, it's official now. We had maybe a tiny dash of hope that there was going to be a racing centric group that was going to buy Arlington. Not the case now with the Bears. And before I toss it to Bill, I think about this, you know, in terms of the future of, you know, community institutions. And now we're losing two of them in Chicago in one fell swoop. We're losing Arlington Park and we're losing Soldier Field. You know, Soldier Field will probably still be there. If you're unfamiliar, Soldier Field is where the Bears have played forever. The Bears are one of the oldest football franchises in America. They've played at Soldier Field since the team started in the early 1900s. And, you know, now I don't even know what's going to be there. Maybe Notre Dame will play there every once in a while, but, you know, it's really going to, Chicago is going to lose the incentive to keep up Soldier Field. So we're really losing two institutions in one. It's unfortunate, but it's the way of the world. Every team wants a new stadium eventually. You know, I remember when they tore down the old Yankee Stadium for no reason, just so that they could build a $1 billion monument to George Steinbrenner that's five times uglier than the old Yankee Stadium. Bill, what are your thoughts on this? But just also on that specifically, if you can, you know, what this means to lose really two iconic buildings in Chicago in one swoop.
Yeah, having never been to Soldier Field, I don't really have a lot to say about that. But, to lose Arlington, well, we've been dealing with this for the last 2 years or so, so we knew it was coming. A couple of things, like you said, if there was a tiny, tiny scintilla of hope that maybe something would happen and a group would come in to save Arlington Park, you know, that's kaput. And the interesting thing is that we don't know what the bids were, and I guess we never will. Did the Chicago Bears have the biggest bid? And, you know, they didn't necessarily have to, because here's why, Joe. This is perfect for Churchill Downs because they wanted to sell the track and to a company who would guarantee its future would never include a casino. And you're not going to tear down the new football stadium to build a casino. But if somebody had come in and kept Arlington Racing, conceivably they could have had a casino somewhere down the line. But also, another thing that strikes me, remember, this isn't the first time this has happened. Churchill Downs didn't sell Hollywood Park to the Chargers and the Rams, but they were part of the process of the end of Hollywood, sold it to someone else. And now that, too, was a football stadium. So I guess if you're looking to build a new football stadium, you ought to give Churchill Downs a call. I mean, I hate to even say this jokingly, but if the Saints need a new stadium, is Fairgrounds available to them? You hate to think about those sort of things. But, you know, it's in some sense, it's the story now is how do you move on in Chicago racing? And this is a story that I don't think people have been talking nearly enough about. I don't see how Chicago Racing could get by now to have Hawthorne run for 3 months, have 3 months off, and have Hawthorne run again for 3 months. Where are those horses going to go during the summer? If they go to another racetrack, why would they come back? They'll have, where are they going to train? You know, this Chicago Racing next year is going to be a complete mess. And there's no, you know, obvious solutions out there how to fix it, or at least that nothing's going to happen in the next couple of years. And, you know, I think we're going to see something really ugly next year with Illinois Racing.
Yeah, well, that hit to Chicago Racing, like you said, will have a negative impact on American racing as a whole. You know, losing a racetrack in such a major city like that, with access to sporting fans, with access to, you know, people of wealth, you know, not having racetrack there. You know, I just feel like we've seen recently at Keeneland September, a strong domestic market of people coming in, you know, new investors wanting to buy horses, but wanting to be involved. Losing a major racetrack in a major metropolitan area like that is not a step forward at all for American racing on the whole.
Yeah, well, I wanted to read this quote from the Churchill CEO, Bill Carstangen. He says, "This has been an extraordinarily competitive bid process. Congratulations to the Chicago Bears for their professionalism and perseverance. It is clear that they are committed to an exciting vision for their team and their fans. We wish them the greatest success and are excited for the opportunity this brings to the Village of Arlington Heights and the future of economic development of this unique property." That struck me because just the celebratory nature of it and the fact that they don't even mention that there was a racetrack there. Like, I don't know. That to me, I think, is what rubs a lot of people the wrong way. It's not necessarily that Churchill decided to sell the property. You know, they're a corporation. They need to make money for their shareholders. I think that the reason that people feel so betrayed by them is, one, that they lobbied alongside them to get the casino license and then decided not to build the casino once they got it. But also just this, like, this complete ignoring of the history of Arlington Park and racing at Arlington Park. Like, if you read that quote and you didn't see it was from the Churchill Downs CEO, you would have thought it was just from some real estate developer, some random disconnected from racing real estate developer. And I think that is the real problem here, is that, you know, just get out of racing. Just get out of racing entirely. If you're Churchill Downs and you don't want to be involved with racetracks anymore because casinos are more profitable, just, you know, pitch out, you know, kick out those properties from your portfolio and let people who care about racing run them. Because, you know, I get that it's a tough business and a racetrack is a big parcel of land and you got to spend a lot of money to maybe make a tiny bit of a margin. But Naira seems to be doing it okay. Strani Group seems to be doing it okay because they actually have a vision for racing and for the product that built their companies and their corporations. And Churchill Downs just doesn't have that anymore. Although if they didn't have the Derby, honestly, I don't think they would want Churchill Downs either. And, you know, that to me is kind of an unsustainable thing when you have a company that, you know, owns so many key pieces to the racing landscape and just has, you know, profess no interest whatsoever in keeping the racing going. You know, I agree with Bill that I don't know that Fairgrounds is long for this world either. And, you know, that's pretty unfortunate because, you know, like you guys say, to have these tracks in these big hubs, these big cities, you know, it does help with the visibility of racing. It does help create new racing fans over time. And this is just another one of those cases where you kind of have the wolves running the hen house. I would say that, you know, Churchill is just doing this. They're just, you know, inching along with the tracks as long as they can before they can sell them, before they can, you know, make all of this money for their shareholders. And I just wish that if that's how they feel, which it seems like it is, and they don't have any interest in running racetracks, sell them to somebody who actually cares and who actually wants to keep the sport going, because you're making so many enemies in this industry and you've made yourself look so bad and so heartless and soulless. And I guess you don't care because the stock prices are going up, but this is just, I believe in karma. And I think that this is terrible karma for Churchill and all of the executives there to just completely abandon what built their company in the first place. The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. We mentioned last week they had a 90% clearance rate at Keeneland. That's great. Great for the consigners, great for the sellers, great for the buyers, great for the sale. So congratulations to them. And we also talked about that $710,000 City of Light colt that sold to Mayberry Farm. So congratulations again to Tommy and Wendy on a successful Keeneland September sale. And we'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
All right, so this is very exciting. We have a contest. We're doing a TDN Writers Room contest, and it's not just a three-year-old contest. We have a contest for our viewers and our listeners. Have you ever wanted to name a horse, but you don't have enough money to buy one yourself? That's a problem that I've dealt with throughout life. I have so many names for horses and no one ever listens to me because I don't have any money to spend to buy the horse myself. Even John Green, like I nudge him and try to give him names and he refuses. But John Green did buy a horse at Keeneland September by honor code out of Nikki New. And we're having a contest to name the horse. Now, we might be putting up video or photos of the horse right now or the catalog page. So we want all of our viewers and listeners, if they've ever had a great name for a horse that they, you know, have never seen before, if they have a specific name that'll be good for this horse, to email Sue Finley. Sue is our boss here at the TDN. Sue Finley at the TDN.com with any names that you come up with. And then for the next 3 weeks, we're going to read some of the best names and we're going to go through them. And then in the fourth week, we're going to award the winner and we're going to send them all sorts of honor code and Lane's End gear. And also you get to see your name on the racetrack next year. So that's exciting. Maybe that horse and Writer's Room will clash at some point, and then we'll have to decide who to root for. But Honor Code honestly has had a tremendous year. Max Player is a huge update for him after winning the Grade One Jockey Club Gold Cup with a 102 buyer. He's arrived at Santa Anita and he's prepping for the Breeders' Cup Classic in Del Mar. I know Bill's a huge fan of his, and we're excited to see what he can do. Also, Maracuja, who had an impressive win in the Grade One Coaching Club American Oaks, beating Malathot. And Clariere in there, and Clariere just came back to win the Cotillion. We didn't mention that. And also last year, Honor AP was one of two horses and the only colt to beat Horse of the Year Authentic when he won the Grade One Santa Anita Derby. Honor Code has 5 black type winners this year and 13 black type horses, which is a very good number. And he had an exciting yearling in book 2 of the recent Keeneland September yearling sale. He sold for $430,000 to Woodford Racing and friend of the show, West Point Thoroughbred. So send in those names. Nothing is too raunchy. You know, we have to get it past the jockey club, but I'll read them and I'll laugh at them if you send in something a little risque. But we're looking forward to that. So if, like I said, if you've ever had a name that you wanted to see on a horse, or if you can come up with something clever for Honor Code out of Nikki New, send that in and we'll get you a prize at the end. And we're going to read the best names in the next couple of weeks. So we're very much looking forward to that. And we hope you are too, and you're excited about it. And we'll be right back after this message from Honor Code and Lane's End.
Honor Code, a multiple Grade One winner from the final crop of the legendary AP Indy. Never off the board in 11 starts, he was crowned champion older horse before retiring. Now, he's living up to the promise of his pedigree with progeny like Grade One winner Honor AP, Grade Three winner Max Player, and multiple six-figure yearling sales. Honor Code stands to continue his sire's legacy at Lane's End.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales, visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
Owning potential future superstars like Flightline is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. westpointsales.com. And we mentioned this last week, how active West Point has been at all the sales, but especially last week at the Keeneland September sale. They purchased 25 yearlings in total through various partnerships for a total of $11.315 million. So big buying power for West Point. And they partnered up to purchase the sale's top three lots, including, of course, the sale topping $1.7 million City of Light Colt, but in partnership with Woodford Racing and Tyler Racing. And they'll now take on the Keeneland Race Meet with Sequist nominated for the Grade One Darley Alcibiades Stakes, which is on opening day next Friday at Keeneland. And Strong Silent is pointing for the Grade Two Raven Run later in the meet. I want to give a hat tip to my buddy Chuck Simon. I'm pointing this out on Twitter yesterday, because honestly, I feel like nobody would have really noticed or made us think about it. But Chuck is clued into these things. There was a horse yesterday at Belterra Park. I don't remember which race it was. It was late in the card. But it was a horse named Mox Nix, who is an 8-year-old gelding by Zangero, and was entered in a bottom level $7,500 maiden claimer off of a near 5-year layoff. Now, the horse had last run in October of 2016 and, you know, honestly made a lot of sense on paper if the horse had run a month ago, but 5 years ago, the horse was clearly had this blinking red light that there was something wrong with it. And lo and behold, the horse got pulled up and vanned off, and Chuck was rightfully so flaming the Belterra Racing office and the people at Belterra Park, which is in Ohio, for even letting this horse run in the first place. I don't understand. For me, you know, I don't know the rules in Ohio and the Ohio Racing Commission and all this stuff, of what authority they have to deny entries. I assume this horse would meet the criteria, but also for me, the horse was owned and trained by a guy named Robert C. Bennett, and he's not like a nobody there. He's run 28 horses at the meet. He's running at 11% rate. I just don't understand what is the incentive to run this horse? Like, why would you bring the horse off of a 5-year layoff, you know, pay the bills, work the horse out, you know, spottily all summer, and then run the horse just to get pulled up and vanned off and potentially euthanized? That's what I don't understand. You know, you can say all you want about the racing office shouldn't have taken the entry, and I totally agree with that. But I just want to get in the head of an owner or trainer. Why even bring this horse back and put them in harm's way when you can, you know, it's not saying that it's easy to find a home for every single horse. Obviously it's not. Horses get lost in the shuffle, unfortunately, but why not just try to find a home for this horse? What is the point of bringing back an 8-year-old gelding to run in a 7,500 maiden claimer? I just don't get it. Bill?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't make any sense, even from the economic standpoint. I mean, you were paying the bills for all these years to feed this horse and keep it in some sort, I assume, at some point in time in training. But Joe, I think the story here is that, you know, there should be a system in place in horse racing so this doesn't happen. And clearly in Ohio and Belterra, there was no such thing. I mean, why did the racing office take the entry? Why did the vet pass the horse and let it run? Why did the stewards do something? You know, somewhere along the line, somebody had to say, this is not okay, and we're not going to allow this horse to run. You know, maybe whether the horse was sound or not, you just can't take these kind of chances. And, you know, the other thing too, and I know I'm speaking to the choir here, why does racing keep shooting itself in the foot with these things? You know, there are plenty of problems in the sport that really are unavoidable, and there's no real easy solutions to them. Here's something that is so easy to get right. No, Mr. Bennett, you cannot run this 8-year-old horse off a 5-year layoff. We just are not going to allow you to do it, and we encourage you to find a home for the horse. You know, as I said, the racing commission is a steward, track management, the track vet. Somebody along the chain needed to make that decision to keep this from happening. And, you know, the system just completely failed. And it's, again, a black eye to the sport.
Yeah, I think, you know, looking at it at face value on paper, sadly, it looked as if, you know, this individual, the only thing they could have been thinking is maybe I can somehow squeeze some more money out of this horse. I don't see any other reason why they did this. But as you said, the economics really don't make a ton of sense. Like they had to feed this horse for 5 years. They had to, you know, put it back into training. You know, why not place it in one of the many programs, you know, that there are to rehome these horses? And, you know, as you both have, you know, very rightfully pointed out, there's a large chain of command here. How did, you know, anyone along this chain of command not catch this? It's just a real terrible look, a real bad situation. And, you know, you'd think that with that chain of command in this industry, you know, somewhere along the line, someone would find it. We could police ourselves. Clearly, that's once again not the case. You know, and we'll see if, you know, if and when HISA eventually gets through, if they might have something to say that could, you know, put in policing for, you know, stop terrible, unfortunate situations like this.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up HISA too, because there was a report last week that there was yet another lawsuit to try to stop it from, you know, taking effect next year with a bunch of states, several of which don't even have racing that were suing to stop this. And it was clearly a very well-researched suit because they kept calling it the Horse Act. And that clearly showed a lot of really they knew what was going on and what was being proposed here. This is the kind of stuff that thankfully does not get picked up by national media, because there's no defense for this. You know, there's absolutely no defense. Even with the Bob Baffert thing with the Medina Spirit DQ, you can say that the horse, you know, had a permitted medication that was a slight, you know, bit over the threshold. There's at least a defense for stuff like this, For this, there's absolutely no defense. And we're just, I guess, lucky in a way that it happened at this track that nobody cares about, that it didn't get picked up by the AP or whatever, because this is the kind of stuff that gets let happen at a lot of smaller tracks across the country. And, you know, it's a lot of times it's tracks where they have casinos that's really all they care about is the casino part of the track, and the racetrack, they really could give a shit about anything that happens there, and they let it go by the wayside, and, you know, whatever horses run there and break down there, who cares? We're continuing to print money because of these slots. I think that may be the case here. And someone mentioned in the comments that it's the same gaming company that owns Evangeline Downs, which I think has a pretty poor record of horses, you know, being lost in the shuffle and ending up in kill pens. This is like, this is something where you don't have the people in charge who really care about the horses and about the product. Now, I'm not accusing Churchill Downs of doing any stuff like this, but it's kind of the same symptom where you don't have people that were interested in the racing product running the business. And so a lot of shenanigans happen. And this is, you know, this is something that Bill says is a very easy fix, because there are theoretically supposed to be people in charge whose job it is to catch this kind of thing and to stop this kind of thing before the horse gets on the track and potentially breaks down. And this is, I think, eventually the kind of thing that trickles up in racing, where you let a lot of stuff slide at smaller tracks, and then it gets to a bigger track, and then you have a breakdown problem because there was, you know, negligence, or there weren't people with the right, you know, with their heart in the right place watching things. And this is just something that, you know, it's indefensible, and it makes you feel gross, honestly, to be a racing advocate, which I consider us on this show. We try to, you know, take the positive side of things and what can we do better, and what, you know, we say that most horses are treated well, and you know, most trainers are doing the right things, and most owners are doing the right things. But when you have stories like this, it's very hard to say that credibly, to look into a camera and say that racing does right by its horses most of the time, because there is too much of this stuff still going on across the country. And I appreciate Chuck pointing it out on Twitter, because it really does not get noticed. There are places, you know, I hate singling tracks out, but I've seen stuff like this at Mountaineer Park in Charlestown, and, you know, horses coming off of huge layoffs and not, you know, it just there's never any kind of accountability for running horses like this that clearly should not be racing anymore. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Bill reported on this earlier in the week. The Monmouth handle overall showed an increase for the meet, which is unsurprising considering there were 11 more cards than last year's COVID-shortened meet, but average daily handle was down significantly. This was kind of a continuing story for us throughout the summer. And once the whip ban was instituted at Monmouth Park, we were trying to, you know, gauge whether or not that would affect handle. And there was actually some very good quotes from Bill in the story from Dennis Drazen talking about how some of the whales that he knows that used to bet Monmouth are betting less. I just wanted to give you the numbers real quick before I toss it to him. Last year, they had 44 cards, and the average handle last year was a little over $3.8 million a day. This year, it was a 55-day meet, and the average daily handle was $3.15 million, so it was a decline of a little over 17%, which is significant for sure. Dennis Drazen also tried to blame the weather a little bit. I don't know that you can really blame the weather when Saratoga's blowing handle records out of the water, and they pretty much had similar weather to Monmouth over the summer. I think it's hard to say. I think it's hard to draw definite conclusions that this was because of the whip ban. I think overall the Monmouth product has been sliding over the last 10 years or so. But I wonder what Bill's takeaways were.
Well, you know, was it so they're down 17%, and that's a big whack. It really is. Is it because of the whips? I guess, I think it's fair to say that the whip ban did have something to do with that, which is unfortunate. But, you know, a lot of gamblers warned the New Jersey Racing Commission we're not going to bet on this stuff because of the unknown factor. One other thing, too, and Dennis went to the playbook. When the handle's down, always blame the weather. It doesn't matter. But I think one other factor in this that was overlooked is that you talked about Saratoga. And Joe, Saratoga, Del Mar, Keeneland, et cetera, the real premier meets, the handle's going through the roof. And yet overall handle in the sport is not increasing. So what's happening is they're taking handle away from other racetracks. So I'd be curious if racetracks kind of comparable to Monmouth, like maybe Maryland, places like that, if they're also down in that same sort of neighborhood, 15-16%. But I'm kind of getting off track here. You know, look, I've been said on the show at least a dozen times or so that I am in favor of the whip ban, you know, for reasons I don't need to continue to beat that drum. But, you know, if you want to say that the gamblers are not comfortable with this and are betting less money, I think this is evidence that that's correct.
And I think it's just, you know, we focus so much on the whips and whether or not the whips should be allowed. I think it's just one of those things where when you have an already deteriorating betting product that you then introduce another variable to, I think that's a recipe for disaster. And I think that that's the case at Mama. And, you know, you talk about Keeneland and Saratoga and Del Mar handle being great. Kentucky Downs handle, it was obviously terrific. I think, you know, you guys know my feelings. I think that they should have whips. I think that it should be, you know, humanely restricted and regulated to the best of our ability, but I don't think you should take them away entirely. I think a lot of it though is the betting product at Monmouth. I think that handle was going to be down no matter what this year, especially going up against Saratoga with the return of fans there. I think Saratoga took all the spotlight this summer. I think handle was going to be down no matter what. I think that this was just another wrinkle that horse players did not want to deal with at a track where you really just, a lot of times you have a parade of 3 to 5 favorites winning and short fields and a lot of trainers you don't trust that they're doing right by the horses. I think Monmouth has a lot of problems to clean up. And I think that they were kind of put in a tough position here with the whip ban. They were kind of the guinea pig for this experiment. Obviously didn't go well, but I think that, you know, I don't know that you can blame the weather and the whip ban entirely for the way that Monmouth handle is trending. I think that there are a lot of things that Monmouth needs to clean up if it's going to be a viable racetrack in the future. And, you know, Dennis Drazen mentioned in the story that he thinks that, you know, when HISA takes effect, if HISA takes effect, that there's going to be more uniform whip rules and they're not going to stand out as much in terms of restrictions. So I kind of get that argument, and we'll see what's proposed for HISA in terms of whips. But I think overall Monmouth needs to kind of get its act together in terms of getting cheaters out of there and just, you know, creating a much more attractive betting product, because it's kind of been the Wild West for a while, and it does not, it, you know, even beyond like the moral conundrum and the moral like hesitancy you might have betting a track where you feel like there are a lot of cheaters flourishing. I think practically it makes it a poor betting proposition too, because you have these giant favorites and these short fields, and it's just, you got to give me a reason. You got to give me a reason to bet your racetrack. I talked about it last week with Parks. They had a great card, but I just can't support it because of the high takeout. And I think horse players in general are becoming more sophisticated, and they're becoming more selective in what they play. And Monmouth is just not doing enough to become an attractive destination for horse players' money. And it's not just the whip ban, although I'm not going to pat myself on the back, but I did say that this was going to negatively affect handle, and it, in a way that it didn't at Woodbine, because you still did have the crops, you know, and in certain situations. So, you know, we'll see going forward. We like Monmouth. We like going there. It's the home track for a lot of people in this company, and we don't want to see it go away, but it's trending in the wrong direction, and there's a lot that needs to turn around, and you can't just blame it on the whips and the weather. All right, so this is a massive, massive weekend of racing on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm glad Kelsey is here so she can fill us in on what to watch for on Arc Day. I want to start with the American side of it. We, you know, Friday is opening day at Santa Anita, and they get right into it with four stakes. They have three Breeders' Cup winning year in races. They have the Grade One American Pharaoh for 2-year-olds, the Grade Two Chandelier for 2-year-old fillies. They also have the Eddie D Stakes and the Speakeasy, which is for 2-year-old turf sprinters. Got a big day at Belmont on Saturday as well. We've got the Grade One Champagne, which is also a Breeders' Cup winning year in. The Woodward, which is now back at Belmont. The Miss Grillo, the Belmont Turf Sprint Invitational. A couple graded stakes at Churchill as well. And then on Saturday at Santa Anita, there's the Awesome Again, which is Grade One for older horses going a mile and an eighth. They also have the Rodeo Drive, which is a Grade One for fillies and mares going a mile and a quarter on the turf. The Santa Anita Sprint Championship, which used to be the ancient title, the John Henry Turf Championship, and the City of Hope Mile. Ton of action on Saturday at Santa Anita and Belmont, and then Belmont and Santa Anita keep it going on Sunday. Belmont has the Frisette Stakes, Grade One for 2-year-old fillies, a Breeders' Cup Challenge race. Also the Facing Tipton Wyeth Stakes, which used to be run at Saratoga. It's now 11 furlongs at Belmont on the turf. You also have the Pilgrim for 2-year-old two-year-old colts going a mile and a 16th on the turf. And then the Zenyatta Stakes, which is a Grade Two winning year in for older fillies and mares on the dirt at Santa Anita as well. So there's a ton of action, a ton of Breeders' Cup tickets are going to be punched this weekend, a lot to be excited about. And that'll lead into next weekend, which is Keeneland opening weekend. And we're stoked for that. So yeah, you know, pick your fancy over the weekend. You've got a lot of stuff to look forward to, a lot of stuff to bet. Going to be a lot of big fields. I think a lot of big names racing, but also this weekend is ARC weekend. I'm glad Kelsey's here, so I don't have to fumble my way through it, pretending that I know about all the ARC horses and all the undercard races. So I'll toss it over to Kelsey now. Let's hear what you're looking forward to the most. Let's get a few, a little pick for the ARC. Who you like the best?
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. We've got the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe in Paris, France. It's my favorite race every single year. It's over a mile and a half, Europe's championship middle distance race. Every year, all the best horses in the division show up. It never disappoints. And that's the case again this year. At this stage, we have 16 horses entered still, with the final forfeit stage and the draw to be tomorrow morning. So we'll have our final field at that stage. And Charlie Appleby was on with us earlier, and he told us about his two contenders, At IR and Hurricane Lane. And they are the two favorites, among the two favorites for the race. At IR's favorite at the moment. Hurricane Lane is third choice. And they're both 3-year-old colts by Frankel, who bring just fantastic seasons into the race. At IR won the Derby and the King George, and he is the first colt actually since Galileo 20 years ago to put that double together. So he just has impeccable credentials. And Hurricane Lane won the Irish Derby, the Grand Prix de Paris over this course and distance. So that's a great tick for him. And he also won the St. Ledger a few weeks ago. So, I mean, it's just hard to pick a hole in either of those horses' form. So it's going to be fascinating. A horse that's catching a lot of attention in the betting is Tarnawa, who the American audience will be familiar with. She came over and won the Breeders' Cup Turf last year. She's won two Group Ones over the ARC course and distance. And she was a very good second last out to the co-top rated horse in the world, St. Mark's Basilica, last out in the Irish Champion Stakes. And really the top, you know, form in Europe this year, you know, for that sort of middle distance goes through St. Mark's Basilica. He was retired this week. He was never actually really pointed to the ARC because they've always seen him as more of a mile and a quarter horse. So Tarnawa comes here representing that form. We have Snowfall, who has been the top three-year-old filly in Europe this year. I mean, it was just an incredible winner of the Oaks, the Irish Oaks, and the Yorkshire Oaks. You know, it's interesting. She was beaten very surprisingly in her prep in the Prix Verme over the course and distance a few weeks ago. So, you know, it's not ideal to be going into this race off a loss. But if you want to, you know, take a gamble on her back form, she's you know, going to give you much better odds now. We have Chronogenesis, who's a mare from Japan. And Japan's always a fascinating story surrounding the ARC because they want to win this race so badly. They've never won it. They've come close, you know, numerous times. This mare really brings top credentials into the race. She could be, I'd say she definitely is, you know, one of the better Japanese horses that have come over for the race. So she really has a shot. We are looking at, you know, the weather is always something that you're looking closely at with this race. And unfortunately, unfortunately for some, over the last few days, the chances of rain this weekend have increased in Paris, and it's looking like it is going to be fairly wet weather. It won't be a bog, I wouldn't say like it was last year, but it will be on the softer side. That would probably play against horses like Snowfall and Chronogenesis, might play in the favor of horses like Tarnawa and Hurricane Lane. But to throw a bit of a long shot out there as well, I kind of like a horse called Alan Kerr, who is a three-year-old colt. He actually beat Adair in a Derby prep earlier this season. Now I think Adair has taken huge leaps forward since then. So I'm not saying Alan Kerr is better than him. However, Alan Kerr has also, you know, continued to improve with each race throughout summer. He's been placed in some of the top middle distance races. He was second in the Judmont International behind Mishriff. So he's one. He's at 25-1 right now. He's one that I, you know, would take a little gamble on.
We appreciate that insight and throwing a little long shot in there as well. John's usually too cowardly to pick any long shots, so we appreciate that and all of the insight. We're really looking forward to it. Sunday morning, do you know the exact post time?
I can find out.
I feel like it's usually around 10:30 our time.
It's 10:05 a.m. Eastern time.
Okay. Cool. All right. Straight. Appreciate that. Kelsey. Oh yeah. So, and you know, whatever you're into this weekend, European racing, American racing, lots to look forward to. And a lot, you know, I think this is the big weekend where the Breeders' Cup fields really start to take shape in people's minds. And we kind of get a sense of what we're going to look at in the Breeders' Cup. It's obviously going to be a tremendous weekend of racing no matter what, but I think a lot rests on what happens this weekend and next, and we're looking forward to all of it. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. A reminder that the Keeneland Fall Meet starts next Friday with Fall Stars Weekend. It's going to be a tremendous, tremendous meet, and obviously the Keeneland September sale wrapped up last week with great results. Congratulations to everybody at Keeneland for getting through that, and you know, it was great to watch, and it was great to see, you know, the vibrancy back at Keeneland September after last year and then the COVID situation. So congratulations to all y'all. Looking forward to the Keeneland Fall Meet. I want to thank Bill Finley, Kelsey Riley, our Green Group guest of the week, Charlie Appleby, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, Nathan Wilkinson. Don't forget to send in those names for the honor code, Nikki New Progeny for John Green. We look forward to all those names and you know, be as creative and as, like I said, as raunchy as possible. Might not get past the Jockey Club, but we want to see everything that's in our listeners and viewers' brains. You can email them to SueFinley@thetdn.com. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching. We will see you next week.